G'day, I'm Osher Ginsburg.
And I'm Charlie Clawson.
We are two dads who, when we found out we were going to be dads, went looking for a podcast that could help us navigate what it means to be a dad in the modern world.
I mean, there were parenting podcasts, but they all seemed to be aimed at mums, or at the very least, mums and dads.
Yeah, there were no podcasts for dads specifically, and certainly not dads who want to be hands-on and do their share of raising their children.
So, we started Dad Pod, a podcast by dads, for dads who don't want to be shit dads.
Each week we share our own stories from the good and the bad to the thermonuclear tantrums, as well as talk with some of the biggest experts in the field to help all of us become better dads.
So if you're a dad, a mum dad, or a dad-to-be, search Dad Pod where you get your podcasts.
The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15 or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. I'm Charlie Clawson, and my guest this week is the Sultan of Cinema. He's the Pharaoh of the flicks. He, of course, is Guy Davis, a film expert extraordinaire, returning to FOFOP. Oh, I can't even speak. Podcast am I doing? Returning to FOFOP. Returning to FOFOP. Guy, how you going?
I am well, Charlie. Look, it's Friday afternoon as we record this. A little bit of stumbling is, of course, par for the course, shall we say. Well, but very good to be here again.
I've changed my diet in the last few days, and I've thought I'll give dairy a bit of a break for a while. So I've been having my coffee with like macadamia milk, and I don't know if there's something about dairy where it takes the edge off caffeine, but I feel like I'm in that movie Spun, like that I'm on really hard speed. Like I'm sweating, my brain's scattered, I can't quite think, and it's all off one cup of coffee like 3 hours ago.
Holy moly, man. Well, you're holding it together well so far, but we'll see how we travel over the next hour or so, because I think this is a topic that we can probably hold forth on for some time.
Yeah, well, this is a rare example of so it's the video store. Guy always comes on for the video store episode of FOFOP. I'm going to do it. I did it again. And he normally always brings the great ideas, but I had an idea for a subject, which I thought, let's talk about our favorite sleazeball actors, as in not real life sleazeballs, as in typecast as sleazeball actors. Now, it's sort of fairly appropriate that I'm incredibly sweaty and speaking really fast. Because there is, you know, I think there's two school of thoughts when it comes to the sleazeball. There's those kind of actors who do sleazeball really well, and then there's the other actors who just have an innate quality of that is kind of off-putting. Now, there's a lot of actors and actresses that, you know, we kind of talked about and thought about throwing into the mix. I've got some honorable mentions, and then we can get into our list proper. Now, I thought I'd start with not really like a great sleazeball actor, but probably the greatest sleazebag role of all time, which is Hart Bochner in Ellis, of course, in Die Hard, which is probably like the quintessential cinematic sleazebag. Would you agree?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, just pure cokehead, pinstripe yuppie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a really, really marvelous performance because, I mean, you look at Bochner and you think, oh, that's a handsome-looking dude. You know, he should traditionally be a leading man type or something like that. And he just slid so easily into the skin of this polar opposite of John McClane in Die Hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think a phrase that I'm probably going to use maybe way too often during this podcast is they really just made a fucking meal out of it. Because, I mean, yeah. I think Hart Bochner saw Harry Ellis and just goes, oh, I can have some fun with this. And he really does. Just everything he does from the way he carries himself, I mean, he's a big guy, but he's sort of slouching. Mm. You know,
it's big dick energy. He's got that big dick energy. That's what
he doesn't feel like he needs to try.
Yeah.
Even though he really probably does. But I mean, of course, everyone knows it's just the pivotal Ellis moment when he's trying to negotiate with Alan Rickman. Hans. He thinks he's got the upper hand.
Will be.
He just does the little thumbs up.
Yeah.
It's so great. It's so great. Hart Bochner, he never really sort of had the career that you would think someone who acts well and looks like he does actually did. He moved behind the camera for a bit, and he's the co-star of one of my favorite unsung movies. It's a thriller. It came out roughly the same time as Die Hard, called Apartment Zero. And it's basically a two-hander set in Argentina, and it's him and a very young Colin Firth.
Mm.
And I've got to put on my pretentious hat. Do you know the Ingmar Bergman movie Persona?
No.
Okay. Two people, and it sort of have what you think is an uneven power relationship. One is a movie star, and one is the nurse who's sort of looking after this mentally fragile actress. And their roles sort of shift, and the power balance sort of shifts over time. And this is like that for dudes, except like it was directed by Pedro Almodovar or something. It's really heightened and sexy and operatic almost, and just a really great performance by Bochner, and also by Colin Firth. So yeah, Hart Bochner, but I think when his time comes, and you know, we'll miss your Hart when you shuffle off this mortal coil, but it'll be Hart Bochner, best known as Ellis from Die Hard, died today at the ripe old age of, let's say, 98. Let's give him a good long innings.
I mean, if you're only ever going to be remembered for one performance, that's as good of a performance to be remembered for. Like, that is...
I think so.
It so crystallizes the worst aspects of the 80s. Like, that is the Reagan era, like, 80s douchebag. And he just... I mean, as a kid, I was too young to even get the cocaine references, the idea that, like, John walks on him doing coke. But as you get older, you're like, oh, man, like, this guy is every dickhead I've met at a bar in Sydney.
Sum it up in three words. You know, oh, actually, no, sorry, seven words. Show him the watch. It's a Rolex. Punch this guy out.
Another actor that I initially had in my main list, but I moved down to the honorable mention for similar reasons, because I think that he just did a couple of real good douchebag sleazy roles well and forever became sort of remembered for that. But then if you look at his actual IMDb list, he's done a lot of stuff. He's William Atherton, most famously Walter Peck. This man has no dick from Ghostbusters. Like, Walt, and he has a sort of 1-2 punch of Ghostbusters and then Die Hard. And it's like, from what I understand about him, his life was unbearable, like from the late 80s onwards. Because... just certain actors make such an impression, and he is so good at playing that kind of like uppity, pretentious douchebag, the crusty old dean, you know, like that kind of archetype that you just want to see just get their comeuppance. And I think that, like, my vaguest memory of the last time thing I saw him in was Biodome. And I remember going, oh, cool. Like, William Atherton, like, he wasn't playing that kind of the dickhead role. William Zabka, you could have probably put into this category prior to Cobra Kai coming out, and sort of he's completely rehabilitated his image. But in terms of just being that, like, especially in the 80s, there was like two guys on your speed dial if you're a Hollywood director or producer looking to put a bad guy in your film.
It's like, two generations of, your junior varsity guy is Billy Zabka, and your middle management guy is William Atherton.
That's right. You're right. One's a high school bully / college bully. The other one's kind of middle management office bully.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's funny you mentioned Krusty Old Dean as well, because I mean, Atherton, I think before that 1-2 punch you mentioned of Die Hard and Ghostbusters, maybe in between, there's a movie called Real Genius with Val Kilmer.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and he's the... somewhat shady professor in that.
Jerry Hathaway.
That's right, yeah. And he's basically manipulating these genius kids into creating weapons for the government or something along those lines. And then, you know, Val Kilmer and his buddies aren't having any of that.
Yeah.
But the thing of it, I mean, I think Atherton actually started out as kind of a fresh-faced leading man. He was the lead opposite Goldie Hawn in Steven Spielberg's maybe his first theatrical feature called The Sugarland Express.
Yeah. Well, he kind of, you can imagine him having like a Paul Bettany kind of energy, you know, sort of like a sophisticated, well-educated, you know, kind of leading man, good looking. But then there's certain actors where when they hit upon the archetype that fits them like a glove, you're like, oh, okay. Unfortunately, your archetype is reprehensible douchebag.
That double-edged sword is like, pal, you're gonna keep working for decades, but yeah. Every trip to the grocery store is just going to be terrible for you.
Well, the rest of my list, and we'll get to them, actors who are actually, you know, really good and can play a variety of roles, but I think what they do quite well or where they excel is in that sleazebag weirdo role. Just one final honorable mention, because we briefly touched on this off air, but I was going to put Amanda Plummer in because she's an actress who whenever I see her in something, I'm always like, oh man, she's so weird. what is going on in her head? Like you just don't, some actors you see them in films and you feel they're so authentic. You feel like, did they even know that there's a camera rolling? Like I just can't imagine like the director calls cut and Amanda Plummer just drops her character and then goes to the catering table with everyone else. Like I just imagine she arrives weird and leaves weird. I mean, I have no idea and no basis for that assumption.
Well, it's true. I mean, I think listeners will probably know her best as Honey Bunny.
Honey Bunny
from Pulp Fiction, right? And that's just one of the great acting hairpin turns in my memory. I mean, just, she's curled up with sitting opposite Tim Roth at the diner and, you know, you get the feeling she's the warm one. She's the stabilizing influence. Mm. You know, and she's clearly infatuated with this guy. And then all of a sudden you study a little inkling. It's like, oh, there's sparks going on inside this woman. And then bang, up on the table, got the 38 in the hand and just telling all these motherfuckers not to fucking move. It's, God.
And there's also like a fragility to the performance as well, especially when you sort of jump back to that scene towards the end of the film when the tables turn and, you know, they realize they're dealing with a bad motherfucker. And she gets really scared and she's going to pee her pants and stuff. And
she wants to go home. Like, she wants to go pee.
Yeah, you've got so much kind of sympathy for her. But yeah, she and I, as I said to you off air, I had no idea she was Christopher Plummer's daughter, which kind of blows my mind a bit because I just would have thought that Christopher Plummer would just, you know, create an army of austere Christopher Plummer offspring. not little twitchy weirdos.
Just this cloner army of urbane types. But yeah. Christopher Plummer's done his share of weird stuff as well. Yeah, I was watching some movie the other day that links into what I'm going to be talking about because it stars one of my sleazebag actors. This 80s sci-fi B-movie called Dreamscape, in which he's a very shady government guy. Is there any other kind? And I'm watching him going, What are you doing here that's making you... You're not blinking at all. Oh, you're like a reptile. It was so good. He will occasionally surprise you, Christopher Plummer, because you're right, so urbane, so austere. You know, got that lovely voice and that lovely bearing, and then, there's something going underneath the surface. It's just strange and disturbing. Yeah.
Well, speaking of reptilian actors, that's actually a good segue into the first actor that I want to talk about, which is William Billy Fichtner, who people might know as the creepy weird cop from Go. Probably, what's his biggest role? I mean, it might even be like, in terms of most people know most, maybe The Dark Knight. You know, he's the bank manager at the start of The Dark Knight.
That's right, yeah. Prison Break, does anyone remember the show Prison Break?
Oh, was he in Prison Break?
I think he came on in like season two or season three. As some lawman who was after the Prison Break brothers.
Yeah.
And he just, like Pulp Fiction, he was just like the shot of adrenaline in that show, which wasn't bad. It was perfectly good. It was perfectly fun. But all of a sudden, he's playing this offbeat, twitchy lawman, possibly addicted to some kind of drug.
Yeah.
Or maybe just the thrill of the chase. But I think, is maybe the best one. But also, The Dark Knight. It was great, you know, when The Dark Knight opens. And it's hey, that's Victor. But you know that Michael Mann, Christopher Nolan making The Dark Knight was very influenced by Heat.
Yeah.
And Fichtner's in Heat as Van Zandt. Right.
Yeah. I mean, he does have that. I mean, he kind of looks like a gecko. Like he's got a chameleon. He's got those big sort of like, you imagine those eyes move independently of each other, but they don't. But there's a quality to him. And I guess sort of Go is the one that I think of the most because there is, because the character in Go, that he's presenting one side, which is, you know, he's a very waspish looking dude, But then almost like a self-contained David Lynch movie, there's something weird happening under the surface. Yeah. Like, and go at some weird kind of sexual, you know, potentially Christian thing happening under the surface.
Aren't they like multi-level marketing or something, or Amway or something?
Yeah, that's right. But it has that kind of, it has this sort of cultish kind of vibe to it. And I think that that is the thing that always comes across with him, is this, it's this idea that there's something broken about this guy. Like, he presents like a normal dude, you know, in the right role. You could almost think he'd be sort of, you know, he's not unappealing. He's not ugly, but there is just something like, oh, does he, when, because those big bug eyes. And well, I mean, if you're listening, Billy, I love you, but those big eyes,
like, got the bug eyes.
You imagine that he is like, as you're talking, he's secretly wondering how he can skin and eat you.
It's true. I mean, it's kind of that Christopher Walken thing. I mean, you know, certain angles, it's like, oh, you're the most beautiful man who ever lived. And then another angle, it's like, oh, yeah, you definitely have a sex dungeon.
Yeah. And I also think, too, there's an element, like, he often gets cast in military or, like, police enforcement roles, which I think does sort of speak to that deeper distrust we have for authority, that, like, although he has the badge, because another film we've talked about in previous episodes of The Video Store is Strange Days. And he's
I just remembered. Yeah, that's right. He was the cop opposite D'Onofrio in Strange Days.
Yeah, and he's the psychotic cop. And I think that there is an element of that as well. It's like, oh, yeah, so you get pulled over for a speeding ticket, but this cop, deep down, he's going to do something creepy. He's got handcuffs and a gun, and you don't know what he's going to do with it.
Charlie, imagine you are pulled over, random traffic stop. The two cops who pull you over are Vincent D'Onofrio and William Fichtner. Forget it. You're not going home.
The two weirdest dudes in the world. I mean, yeah, I actually think he's a pretty amazing actor. Like, he's done other films where he sort of plays a bit more straight, and he's really awesome. But if you just, I kind of like it when they don't cast him. Like, one of the other actors we'll get to as well, as soon as he's cast, like, if there's any kind of ambiguity about the character's motivation, you know that they're going to be bad. Like, it's like, you need to be more imaginative casting agents of Hollywood. Like, if you're going to put, you know, William Fichtner in your film as the guy who ends up betraying his unit or whatever, we're going to see it coming. I think I'd like to see the opposite now with him, where it's like, oh, you think he's going to be the bad guy, the weirdo, but he ends up being the hero.
Well, there's a movie that he's in, a Nicolas Cage B movie. Is there any
kind? Drive Angry.
Called Drive Angry.
Yeah. Which I saw at the movies in 3D.
In 3D.
Here comes a hatchet. Look out.
where Nicolas Cage literally steals a muscle car and drives it out of hell.
Yeah.
And is pursued by a gentleman named the accountant, who keeps, you know, the ledgers balanced in hell. And it's William Fichtner in a lovely suit, very well spoken. You know, he's looking neat and presentable and all that, except he'll actually literally rip the heart out of your chest if you don't give him what he wants.
He's the best thing in that film. Like, and I think too, it's not, because I remember seeing the trailer for that and being like, oh yeah, I think I'm into this. Like, this looks like a good schlocky kind of, you know, it was when sort of the Grindhouse kind of revival was happening. It was not nearly as, like, it needed to be shot on 16 and to be like real stunts. There's too much CGI.
Little wink as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. And the 3D just completely undermines like any of those kind of action scenes. Like, I don't know why, but I have a very clear memory of one 3D scene where a bad guy throws a hatchet at Nicolas Cage and he like ducks to the side and it slices off like a section of his wig, you know, like, I mean, not his wig, his hair in the film, but like Nicolas Cage's wig. And it's just been like, this is dumb. Like, it needed to be nastier and dumber, but you could imagine William Fichtner going in a Nicolas Cage direction. Like, he has enough weirdness and he's got the same big bug eyes as Nicolas Cage, but he's almost playing the straight man. And I think he does it really well. Like, Nicolas Cage is doing his Nicolas Cagey stuff. But Bill, I keep calling him Billy like he's my mate. Bill Fichtner. I imagine they call him Bill. You're right. He holds that kind of, he has a way of nodding and winking at the camera that isn't too on the nose. Like, you get that he gets that it's a ridiculous premise and a ridiculous film, but he still commits with enough kind of leeway that you're like, oh yeah, this is fun for him.
Absolutely. And incredibly versatile. I mean, he's very threatening actor, but a very funny actor. Yeah, there's not much that he can't do.
Yeah, well, he couldn't save Ultraviolet. That's the one thing.
No one could save Ultraviolet. Do you have movies like that you keep going back to and you think, this is going to be the time that the key turns, because there's something in here that's, it's close. We're so close. I mean, I think we talked about it on movies just like that on a previous episode.
It's, yeah,
like,
maybe it's at a 25%.
You need to be 25% better. Yeah. Ultraviolet needs to be 75% better, but that 25 is like, okay.
Well, I think the major problem is they need to get the corridor crew onto Ultraviolet and to redo all the visual effects, because it's so bad. Like, that's what I think. That, like, you can, I can, I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, CGI, I fucking hate it. Like, if you are aware of the parameters of it and you go into it and it's going to be Sky Captain of the World of Tomorrow or whatever, sure. Like, I understand it. But Ultraviolet is trying to be the Matrix, and it's terrible.
Yeah, it felt like it was trying to be a live-action anime.
Yeah.
And it was like, don't know.
Who is your first sleazebag?
This comes with a bit of a preface. We've spoken in the past about the joys of growing up in the 90s and the 2000s, the pre-streaming, pre-internet, pre-globalization era, where if you wanted information about the world around you, the wider world around you, you had to get magazines, particularly overseas magazines, international ones. And being a little movie nerd, I was a big fan of the 90s of things like Premiere and Movie Line. And when you wanted to go a little upmarket, a little bit posh, there was one called Film Comment that had these, you know, had the occasional very erudite article about some foreign thing, but also, you know, would do articles about the Coens or Clive Barker. Or it's how I first heard about one of my favorite movies of all time, King of New York. I was reading about it and going, this sounds like the shit. When does this open? Took 2 years to get to Australia. I eventually sort of sold off a bunch of those magazines when I thought, they're taking up too much space and all that. But I photocopied a bunch of stuff out of them. And then I lost those.
Oh, no.
But then I found them recently, because there was one article in particular that I was really, really keen on out of Movie Line. And it was an interview by James Ellroy, the great crime author, with, and the article is called The King of Made for Video. It's one Wings Hauser.
Yes.
Yes. Now, what is Wings best known for? Well, he's the, first of all, he's the father of Cole Hauser, co-star of Yellowstone and the villain in Too Fast, Too Furious and a bunch of other stuff. But Wings is best known for just bringing it, you might say, in a variety of usually crime movies, usually direct-to-video back in the day, although he would occasionally pop up in a big screen release. And yeah, it's just like, the big screen is where you belong, Wings, because you are maximalist. You are just
not quite intense. Handsome enough, not quite handsome enough to be a leading man, not quite brawny enough to be an action star. He kind of sits in that middle ground where he's got a great face, like he's really memorable, and he's one of those actors that, especially, you know, if you, you know, in video stores in the 80s and 90s, you knew his face because he was on fucking every second cover, every second knockoff.
Absolutely was. He basically took a role in a movie from the early 80s, I think 81 or 82, called Vice Squad. Now, there were a plethora of movies called like Hollywood Vice Squad and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But this was the original and best Vice Squad, and sort of followed this sex worker through a couple of nights in LA as she plied her trade. But she runs afoul of a pimp named Ramrod, played by our boy Wings. Ramrod is, how do we put this politely, batshit fucking crazy. You know, he sort of dresses country in, like a cross between country and western and disco. And how do you put, he's not polite to his stable. He doesn't treat his stable of ladies well.
I'm just watching the trailer on silently as you're talking. And he's beating someone's head against a steering wheel. This film looks like it was shot on like something between Super 8 and 16.
It's grimy as hell, but it has its fans. I mean, I think Scorsese's a fan of Vice Squad.
Yeah, right.
But it's primarily for Wings Hauser, who just, starts at 100 and then goes from there. It's incredible. I mean, it's... I don't know if it's coke or energy or what, but Wings is pretty amazing, and he even sings the theme song for Vice Squad, a song called Neon Slime. But
yeah. I remember Wings from the early 90s in Roseanne. For one season, he was the Connors' neighbor on Roseanne, and he played the father of Danielle Harris, who film nerds might know as like the Scream Queen from the Halloween films. It was, yeah. So she was the daughter of the little,
daughter no, the last
little
Boy sister. Scout.
Yeah, and the last Boy Scout. But she's a little sister of Mike Myers. I think that was the twist. She Or a cousin. She was some relation to Mike Myers, which ended up being that she was psychotic as well. Because I think
you thought she was going to be like a little Jamie Lee victim, and instead she's just nuts.
Yeah, she's nuts. That's right. Because I had the biggest crush on Danielle Harris. And so like when I loved Roseanne. Like Roseanne's one of my all-time favorite sitcoms. And I remember he was the dad. And it was kind of funny because like Wings, he can play a heavy really well, but in Roseanne, he played this kind of like almost like too nice for his own good, easy manipulated. Like Danielle Harris was this like promiscuous, smart, arsy teenage daughter that he couldn't keep control of. And, you know, the Connors were always like trying to help him out. And I remember just being like, oh, you know, he's the nice dad. And then when I started working in the video store, it's just like every second B movie knockoff is holding a machine gun. I'm like, what, the Connor's nice neighbor is actually like an action hero? This doesn't make any sense to me.
And he directed a bunch of those as well. I mean, movies like Cold Fire or Street Asylum or I'm trying to remember if it's Nightmare at Noon or what else. Deadly Force is one of his. L.A. Bounty, Living to Die. Good stuff by Wings. But every once in a while, you know, some reputable dude would take a chance on, not even take a chance, but it's like, Wings is right. He has a very small part in Michael Mann's The Insider.
Right.
Opposite Russell Crowe and Al Pacino. Or he has a pretty sizable role in the only film to date. Actually, he's dead now, so yeah, it's the only film written, directed by Norman Mailer, called Tough Guys Don't Dance. And yeah, Wings is actually, again, bringing it there. So, he'd pop up in reputable movies, but he really sort of found his groove in B movies and director video stuff.
You feel like he's the kind of actor that, and we probably say this most weeks, that Quentin Tarantino could just like grab and put in one scene in one of his new films. And it's like, oh, he fits that kind of Quentin aesthetic. You know,
absolutely.
In a weird way, he has a Hollywood pedigree, but it's a off-Broadway pedigree. You know, it's all those B movies. It's all genre films. And maybe not a Robert Forster style leading role, but I could definitely see, you know, whatever Quentin's next film is, the crusty cop or the redneck trailer park dad played by Wings Hauser.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the background because, to the best of my recollection, I'm sorry, I don't have my this properly written down, but I'm pretty sure that Wings Hauser is like related to one of the Warner Brothers, as in Warner Brothers?
As in the studio Warner Brothers.
As in the studio. Like he's might be related to Jack Warner or something like that.
Well, let me bring up his So he has a long list of credits. It is enormous. Okay, trivia. Here we go. So how tall do you reckon he is?
See, he looks towering. I would say like 6'2", 6'3".
Oh, you're bang on the money. He's 6'2".
Oh,
okay. Yeah. So let's see. His father was Dwight Hauser, who was big in radio, and his mother was Geraldine Hauser. He was raised by his dad on his own. Doesn't say anything about the Warner Brothers, though. No.
Okay.
He was
Maybe that was a tall tale, or just an absolute mistake.
I'm sorry. I found more. So he's got a daughter who acts as well called Bridget. Hmm. He's a star athlete. Made his acting debut at 5. Big fan of the Dodgers. Wings' wife is related to Edward G. Robinson.
Okay.
Maybe that's where you got it wrong. Yeah, I can't see anything about. Okay, he's got a little quote here about playing Ramrod in Vice Squad. He said, "It's interesting about that role. I didn't prepare a damn for it. I was doing the soap opera The Young and the Restless and dying to get out of it. I'd been on it for about 3.5 years. We were shooting it during the day and all night. I would do Vice Squad. I was so tired. I didn't have any social graces, so I just let go." Well, there you go. There's the explanation.
If you can find Vice Squad, by all means, check it out. It is good and grimy, real good grindhouse stuff.
You know, just let's take a little diversion for a second. Speaking of good and grimy, I know that you saw Prey last week, and you were okay. You weren't effusive in your praise. You thought it did some things competently and other things not. I really enjoyed it. But one thing I really thought it could have done was being shot on film. Like, I really loved the look of it. And I think, you know, the cinematography was amazing, but it was too clean, like, especially for something that was period where there was a lot of mud and dirt and smoke and haze. I just feel like there was some After Effects where they'd put some grain over it, like, it would have really helped the film feel much more visceral.
I think you're right. Yeah, it felt just a bit tidy, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, like the first Predator, like, it feels sweaty and claustrophobic and, you know, you're slapping bugs on the back of your neck and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's really good, an immersive experience. But this one, which I really enjoyed, but it did feel you were distant from the action. You were distant from the experience, like all that kind of like hand-to-hand combat. Like, if it had been gritty and just a bit more edgy, and then there's no way they're ever going to do that, you know, with this sort of mainstream Hollywood film. But I just was like, oh, that's a shame that they didn't just go, hey, why don't we shoot this on 16?
Yeah, this thing, even the sort of sweaty, unshaven French fur trapper types.
It's like, not very clean.
Yeah, you'd look like you've spent a little while in the makeup trailer getting that look. which is a bit of a drag. Yeah, but, I mean, look, it's a pretty good movie, I thought. I mean, like you said, my praise was not guarded or even reserved, but... I mean, I'm just a massive fan of course, the first Predator. I love the second one as well. But, I mean, a critic that I really respect said something on Twitter. It's like, think about the Predator franchises. There's no bad ones. And I'm like, you're not entirely wrong, but you're not right either. I mean, the Predator, the most recent one, the Shane Black one, garbage. But there's some stuff in it that I kind of like.
Yeah.
Even the Alien versus Predator movies. I mean, I quite like the first one. The second one is kind of junk, but it also has a real mean streak as well, which I appreciate. So there's something to salvage in all of them, and some are just unimpeachable masterpieces.
Well, what I think what it appealed to me about it, and I think maybe this appealed to a lot of other people, especially coming off the back of having watched... Before I watched it, I tried to watch Multiverse of Madness. I'm like, fuck, this is like terrible, unwatchable. Everything about it felt so fake and just cookie cutter. Like, his wig, I could not get past Benedict Cumberbatch's wig. It looks terrible. I don't know if it's my HD TV or whatever. But then also Top Gun, I came out of Top Gun going like, what was that? Like, it was just this wanky fan service, and I'm just so over it. To then see another franchise film where it's like, okay, we'll give you a couple little nods at a fan service here. There's going to be a line from the first film. But ultimately, it felt like the same story, but a new version of the story that wasn't obsessed with kind of linking back to the first or linking back to the franchise. I'm sure there's like a million YouTube videos out there with all the Easter eggs and stuff. But to me, it just felt like, oh, yeah, this is cool. This is it reminded me of the Dark Horse comics, where they're like, okay, let's take the Predator and we'll just throw it in an environment where you wouldn't ordinarily think to see a Predator and see what happens there.
Well, that's the joy of the Predator franchise. It really is sort of plug and play in that regard.
Like, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Find a situation, find a potentially badass hero or, you know, someone you can follow and respect, then add Predator.
Yeah, that's great. Musicals coming next.
Just add Predator.
Just add Predator. My next sleazeball weirdo is an incredible actress, very well respected, award-winning, and can do anything. But the reason I sort of selected her is she always makes me uneasy. And similar to Amanda Plummer, when she's on screen, I'm like, oh, what's going on? But even when she's playing like a good character, and that's Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah.
I think Hateful Eight is like, to me, that's like her best ever performance, because I think she was just given complete carte blanche to go actresses also aren't really given the license, or maybe they're too scared to just go super ugly. I don't feel that with her. She does not mind, you know, getting a broken nose, snot, everything. Mm-hmm. Like, she'll do whatever it is that she thinks the character is. You know, Frances McDormand is kind of similar, but I think Jennifer Jason Leigh does the unhinged better than that. And I think of films like... even Miami Blues, Miami Blues.
Miami Blues, yeah.
Miami Blues, yeah. Like, you know, she's just so weird in that film. You know, she's meant to be the hooker with a heart of gold, but she's just kind of got this, always there's something bubbling underneath that you're like, is she going to hug me or kill me? I don't know what's going on.
I think it's, yeah, it's a commonality with the actors that we're talking about today, and you know, supporting actors and, I don't know, bit part actors that we love. They may not have much to work with on the screen, but they always suggest a huge life outside the screen. It's like
100%, yeah.
Yeah. A life on either side and a life you can probably imagine on the other side, unless they get capped, you know, unless yeah. Or, you know, hung or whatever, as what happens to Jennifer Jason Leigh in the Hateful Eight. Spoilers, folks, but there it is. but she was like that from the very, very beginning, because I think she's been working since she was a teenager, essentially. She's the daughter of the late actor Vic Morrow, who, you know, died during the making of Twilight Zone, the movie.
Twilight Zone, yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, she sort of came to prominence in Fast Times at Ridgemont High back in 82 or 83.
Yeah.
And even I mean, then...
It's ridiculous that, like, she's sort of considered this sort of mousy, you know, girl next door because her best friend is Phoebe Cates. But, like, Cates, you put anyone next to Phoebe Cates and they become mousy and girl next door. I mean, she's beautiful. I mean, that's the other thing about Jennifer Jason Leigh. She's really lucky as an actor in that she can play anything. Like, she can play glamorous if she wants, but she can also play ugly. She can do it. She can do it all. I just find her much more interesting when she's playing, like when she's just given license to go weird. Like, Single White Female is probably the one that most people will know. And that's like, yeah, you know, that's like just a potboiler kind of like mid-90s thriller back when they used to make those kind of films.
But a well-made version of it, though. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's got a, got a good cast, got a good director behind the camera, and it's got great production value. It's, I mean, that if that was made or remade today, it'd probably be on Netflix and, you know, starring one of the, you know, actresses from Riverdale and, I don't know, one from another show that I don't
CW
watch.
CW show.
One from the Vampire Diaries.
Yeah, I always feel like though she seems better suited to indies. Like when you see her in like a backdraft or something, you're always like, oh, well, you know, you're happy to see her because she's so good. But it's like, oh, are they going to let her do what she does? Is she allowed to be, you know, really weird? One of my favorite performances, and it's not even really, it's not sort of the sleazy weirdo in the, you know, in the obvious sense, is The Anniversary Party, where she just plays neurotic really well. And Anniversary Party, so I think it was written and directed by her and Alan Cumming. They play husband and wife who just have an anniversary party. And it's one of those kind of ultra, ultra low budget. You know, they just got all their famous actor friends like Phoebe Cates and Kevin Kline to come in and just play ensemble roles. And there's just like this amazing thing where they all take ecstasy. Gwyneth Paltrow comes around as the annoying, I mean, a real precursor to what she would end up being, the annoying, young, beautiful actress who gets everyone high. And, you know, she has this amazing scene where she's high on ecstasy and worried about the state of her marriage to Alan Cumming. And I don't know if it's improvised or if it was scripted, where she just halfway through the scene where they're talking about, you know, I don't know if he loves me or if I'm getting, because she's playing a Hollywood actress. So similar to who she is, where she just lies on the floor because the ecstasy is so strong. She's just like, can we just lie on the floor? It feels so good. And it's just a brilliant bit of kind of, it just feels so real and spontaneous.
And she, yeah, as we were saying about other other actors we've talked about, incredibly versatile as well. She's got a great role in the Coen Brothers movie, The Hudsucker Proxy, where she's basically
she's awesome
playing
in that.
Yeah, playing like a 40s screwball comedy.
Listen here, see?
Doing the Rosalind Russell or the Carol Lombard or something, and really just nailing it. It's fantastic. And it's not really what you would have expected from, but not much she can't do.
Yeah, no, she's incredible. She's incredible. All right, who's your next weirdo?
Weirdo is right. This is an actress no longer with us. Actually, I better double check that, but I'd be surprised if she was because she seemed to have lived pretty rough. But her name is Susan Tyrell.
Now, I had no idea who this was. And even after looking her up, I still have no idea who this is.
Let's have a look here. Sorry, yes, she passed away 10 years ago, June the 16th, 2012. But never forgotten. Not a lot of high-profile titles, but whenever she popped up in something, as you said before, Charlie, you know, it's like, is this person going to stop when I say cut? Do they know the difference between real life and fantasy? Because, yeah, Susan Terrell, wow. I mean, she sort of burst onto the scene. She worked a bit with Andy Warhol and the Factory Guys back in the day when Warhol was making movies. She was in a movie called Andy Warhol's Bad. But I think she sort of got a real start in a movie called Fat City, directed by John Huston and co-starring Stacey Keach and a young Jeff Bridges, about sort of hard luck boxers in California in the 70s. It's a very 1970s movie in that everything is dirty and depressing and there's no hope. Check it out. No, it's a really good movie, but she plays the drunken, I guess, girlfriend of Stacey Keach, who was this washed up fighter who's trying to make a bit of a comeback and also trying to help this young boxer played by Bridges. And it's like, did Huston just go out on the street? Did he go to Skid Row yes. and find someone who has been living rough and said, hey, do you want to be in movies? I'll pay you a sandwich. You know, because when I say feral, I mean it as a compliment. She seems legitimately feral. But right. it's great. It's really, really good. And so, I watched another movie of hers last night. One called it's gone by multiple titles. The one I watched was called Night Warning, but it also goes by the awesome name Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker.
Ah, that's awesome.
That is rad. Great. Why'd they call it Night Warning? That's ridiculous.
Yeah, just greenlight it off the back of the title.
You would, wouldn't you? Just like throw it down the first page. Sold.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and she is the aunt of a young man whose parents were killed when he was a little boy, and she's raised him, and now he's 17. She's taking a little too much interest in him. Right. The way she wakes him up in the morning is perverse, and she's taking way too much interest in the relationship that he has with the nice girl next door, all that kind of business. And she doesn't want him to go to college. She wants to stay and look after her forever. And maybe in other ways, more than just helping around the house, if you know what I mean.
Oh, boy.
And yeah, every time she's on screen, it's like, oh, I feel really nervous for the young actor who's in the scene with her. Cause it's like, I'm guessing she probably knocked on your trailer door a lot and said, you want to run some scenes? Sorry, Susan Terrell, I'm defaming the dead here, but I mean, that's how it feels. She's just
bringing so much quality.
Yeah, febrile, feral energy to it. So, yeah, I mean, and, you know, she, of course, she worked with John Waters later on. She showed up in Crybaby. I was at Johnny Depp. But, yeah, things went a bit rough for Susan later in the game. Fun fact, for a couple of years, she lived with Herb Villechaize, aka Tattoo from Fantasy Island.
Oh, the plane.
Yeah, they had a nice two-year relationship in the mid-70s. Different time, what can I tell you? But she had a terrible blood disease in the early 2000s and had to have both her legs removed.
It looks like they did a documentary on her in 1992.
I wouldn't be surprised.
My Rotten Life, a bitter operetta.
Oh.
Yeah. She wrote it herself, and it's a musical. I'm fascinated. It had a budget of $1,500. Wow. See if you can track that down. Wow, that'd be amazing. Directed by Rocky Schenk, written by Susan Tyrell, starring Susan Tyrell. Susan Tyrell, My Rotten Life, A Bitter Operetta. But, I mean, maybe it isn't a documentary. Maybe it's just a fictional musical, but that's intriguing.
Could well be. But then you look at the rest of her career, and I mean, she worked with guys like, Paul Verhoeven. She worked with Pee Wee Herman. And, of course, she was in the great B-movies Angel, with the immortal tagline, high school student by day, hooker by night, and Avenging Angel. So, Susan Terrell, once seen, never forgotten.
Oh, she's in Flesh and Blood. Yeah, right. With Verhoeven. Yeah, right. So, yeah, it's amazing, isn't
with
it?
With your girl, Jennifer Jason Leigh. With your woman, Jennifer Jason
with
Leigh.
With my woman.
But she was a girl back then, Jennifer Jason Leigh. It seemed like she was about 17 or 18 when Flesh and Blood was made.
Yeah, what was that? So the last film she did was 2012. It's called Kid Thing. Oh, it looks like a sweet little... Annie is a girl with no moral compass, thanks to a lack of parental supervision. That actually looks good. One day while playing in the woods, a voice calls out to her from the deep abandoned well, causing her to consider the right course of action. Well, I'm intrigued. I want to see what that film's all about. All right. My last sleazebag actor is kind of similar to the William Fichtner in that this dude can play really anything, but seems to always thrive when he's playing the sleazebag, and that is Garrett Dillahunt.
Now, love this guy.
Probably the most recent thing people might know him from is Army of the Dead, the Zack Snyder casino zombie heist film, where he plays the most easily identifiable like backstabber in film history. Like just from the word go, like even the characters straight out say that guy's going to backstab us, and they still take him on the mission, which makes zero sense.
They would have just killed him.
I love this dude. Like I can't remember where I first saw him. I think it might have even been. Do you remember there was that Sarah Connor Chronicles, the Terminator series?
That's right, yeah.
And he plays the Terminator in that. And he plays a Terminator who kind of starts to kind of like bug out and you know, discover his humanity. But he's a bad Terminator, like not a good Terminator. And he just has this quality, like Bill Fichtner. He's more handsome than Bill Fichtner. He could easily be a leading man again, but... there is something about him that is just slightly off. It was almost perfect casting to make him like a robot or a cyborg.
Because he plays sort of, still very well.
Yeah, but he also, like in the Army of the Dead, he plays like cocky sleazy really well, which is like a different side to him. But he's done a bunch of kind of, Andrew Dominik's a big fan of him, Assassination of Jesse James, and I think he was in Killing Him Softly as well. But he just... I love him because he just has this sort of quality of, like, again, it's that waspish, you know, could be a Republican voting kind of dude, but you're like, oh, man, like, he could also be a serial killer. He could be a CEO or a serial killer, potentially the same thing.
I'm having a look at his CV now. One of the things I remember him for is that he was initially in Deadwood. He was in the first season of Deadwood, the great HBO That's Western. Right. I think he's the guy who kills... not Jesse James, not Wyatt Earp. Wild Bill Hickok. He shoots Wild Bill in the back. And it was kind of meant to be a one-and-done role for Dillahunt, and they liked him so much they brought him back a few seasons later as a different character. I think they slapped a fake mo on him or something. It's like, Dillahunt, you've never failed to satisfy. Come give us some more of that Garrett stuff. So, And then he popped up in the Deadwood movie that they made, uncredited as Drunk Number Two.
If he's the kind of like, if you think about, you know, the roles that say like a, I don't know, like it. I mean, let's not say Chris Pratt because he's a big star, but if you're a handsome leading man, like a Scott Eastwood, fairly generic milquetoast leading man actor, and I think the reason why Scott Eastwood isn't a bigger star is because he's bland. Like, I don't think he either chooses not to, you know, I mean, maybe he's getting offered bad guy roles and he doesn't take them. But Garrett Dillahunt, I would accept in either. Like, you're going to say, he's the dependable dad, or he's the sleazy, you know, mercenary. I'm going to believe either one of those things. And I'm sure he does both, but he seems to really thrive playing the bad guy. And I think that is what, you look at his list of credits, like William Fichtner, he's done so much stuff. TV and film, and I think it's because he's just like equally adept at both, but really, really good at being the bad guy.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's funny you mentioned Scott Eastwood. I mean, and how he's not offered villains. Probably the best role that he's had to date is in the Guy Ritchie movie Wrath of Man, the Jason Statham one. It's really good, actually. It's a very good gritty crime thriller, and Statham's got his role as Jason Statham, but the plot revolves around this crew of ex-military guys who are pulling armed robberies around LA, and Eastwood is the loose cannon. He's the Wayne Grove, saw my face, bang.
Didn't they try and make him a bad guy in one of the Fast and the Furious films, and then it didn't quite work, so they had to bring in Kurt Russell to kind of bring some charisma? It's essentially the same role. It's like, oh, you're the agent, whatever, generic, you know, government
the
agent.
The man in black, yeah. And
the man in black. But he had no charisma, so it's like, shit, let's get Kurt Russell. He can do the same thing but be super charming about it.
I think, yeah, you think it was like Eastwood's 2IC or something. I think they're bringing back Scott Eastwood for the last Fast and the Furious one. But, yeah, you're right. He's a bit bland. He's a little vanilla. He's sort of lacking Clint's bastardness.
Back to Garrett, when I think I was in LA, or maybe it was actually in Australia at a film festival, I met an American actor called Enver, I don't know how to pronounce his surname, I think it's Jokach, who you might know from Dollhouse. He was in the Joss Whedon series Dollhouse. Mm. He's got a small part in the Avengers. Anyway, he went through NYU drama or whatever, and he said that Garrett Dillahunt was his mentor. When you leave that school, you're assigned a mentor. And he said, like, he is the nicest, most conscientious guy who he can call at any time. And his advice to him, because in Dollhouse, like, I don't know if you remember the plot of that, but it's like, so you've got these essentially like clones who they can adapt to any situation, play any part. They get sort of programmed. They download a kind of personality and they get sent out on assignment. Enver is a really good actor, and he was really good at playing all these different roles. And that was off the back of Garrett Dillahunt saying, hey, if you want to work, make sure you don't just stick the one role. You're a good-looking guy, but just don't go for the leading man roles. Don't be afraid to play a bad guy. Don't be afraid to do bit parts. Don't be afraid to do TV. Don't be afraid. And so I think that, you know, I don't think it's really worked for Enver as much as it's worked for Garrett, but you can sort of see the philosophy in his career.
Yeah, no, Garrett's certainly taken his own advice. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at his IMDb now and it's just stretching on and on and on. And, yeah, so many different things in there. I mean, he's the deputy to Tommy Lee Jones in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah,
so he's right. And sort of the comic relief, if that movie can have comic relief, that's what Garrett provides. Or he's got like a great little part in Looper where he's trying to track down Joseph Gordon-Levitt and using that sort of politeness and ma'am, I'd love a glass of lemonade, thank you ma'am, but then he's just ready to shoot a kid in the head. It's he's good stuff, Garrett Dillahunt. I like that guy.
I think Army of the Dead 2 is the most fun. I did not care for that film at all.
No, me neither.
I liked him a lot because I felt like he got it and he got what the part was meant to be, and he just chewed scenery like you wouldn't believe. And that's what you want from one of those actors. You know, that's why I love a Jennifer Jason Leigh. It's like, yeah, just give her the ball. Let's just pass her the ball and just watch what she does.
But they're also good team players in that if they know they've got a role that's just, okay, I'm the vanilla in this particular Sunday. I'm the vanilla ice cream. I'm not going to try and overpower it. You know, I mean, Jennifer Jason Leigh, when she You mentioned Backdraft. I'd forgotten that she was in that. I was thinking like Road to Perdition, where she was Tom Hanks's wife. Oh, yeah. Thankless role.
It's so many.
Yeah. But it's like she didn't feel the need to, I'm going to give this character a quirk or a tick or anything like that. It's just like, no, I'll just play it as it lays. So, and good on him for that. You know, it's good unselfish work as an actor, which I appreciate and admire.
You sounded very walking then. It's good, unselfish. You say you got a bit walking there. Speaking of sleaze, but the king of the oddball.
I know. We should have a little sort of a little shrine to our man.
He essayed the archetype. Walking.
Bowing down to you.
Oh!
Doing such good work.
Well, that's amazing. Guy Davis with the impressions. Who else can you do?
No, Walken's my go-to. So many times when I was drunk in the 90s, I'd be just doing bits from True Romance and King of New York. It's like, I won't do it anymore now, I'm self-conscious.
No, please. The floor is yours.
Next time.
Okay. All right. Who is your final actor?
My final actor, the triple threat, the triple-barreled name, one David Patrick Kelly.
Yes.
Again, five words.
Audrey Horne's uncle.
Hang on. Five words, seven syllables. Oh, no. Warriors, come out and play. And then he just keeps doing it.
That was his very first role, too. I mean, he's another one of those dudes that you're just like, man, he seems to have, like, you imagine that Hollywood just like chews up and spits out like the good looking ones. But if you're a really good character actor, you'll just work forever. Like,
you will, won't you? Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, he burst on the scene a big way in the Warriors playing playing Luther, who sets the whole plot in motion when he shoots Cleon, the sort of the charismatic gang leader gang who wants leader. To unite all the gangs in New York to basically take over the city.
Why haven't they remade that film yet? You reckon that would be ripe?
They've tried so many times, apparently. Tony Scott wanted to remake it before he died.
Oh, I would have loved to have seen
that. Yeah, and he was right in the middle of his sort of man on fire domino phase where he was really experimenting with visuals and things like that. It would have been kind of interesting. Apparently did a shit ton of research on it. You know, met
I
with
guess
gang-
the problem with doing it now, like there was kind of a like a fairy tale nature to New York in the 70s, you know, where and it does have a, I mean, like it's not realistic gangs, like you know, there's a fucking baseball gang.
The baseball furies, yeah.
Yeah. And nowadays, I guess if you're going to, like it would be all like the fucking Proud Boys and shit. Like it's not fun, is it? Like you got a series of like trans kids being chased by Proud Boys through New York. Man. It's not a fun, not a fun film, really, if you want to make it realistic.
Yeah. But it's funny. I mean, you're right. The Warrior, the original Warriors does have that sort of heightened, almost comic book feel to it.
Yeah.
And then David Patrick Kelly comes in as, this, again, feral sort of gang member who just kills the most powerful gang boss in New York. Yeah, just like doing stuff like that. You know, he didn't have a reason. He didn't have any ulterior motive. It's like, just felt like it. And again, he looks like one of those guys that might have just been picked up off the street. It's like, you look crazy. Can you be crazy on cue?
Yeah.
And so, but of course, that wasn't the case. I mean, he's showed up in a bunch of other movies. And
he's also awesome in The Crow, like T-Bird in The Crow.
That's right.
Like that's kind of, you know, for me, that's kind of like, that's the pinnacle. Like he came off Twin Peaks and then goes into The Crow. And alongside another guy who could make the list, Michael Wincott, top dollar.
Oh,
like Michael
man.
Wincott, like he's so excellent. That voice, like, I mean, it's really just the voice. I've seen, he was in something recently where he played like a good guy. And it really fucked with my head because it's like, oh, isn't Michael Wincott always the bad guy? Because he just has that, like he gets up in the morning and he smokes like 10 packs of cigarettes and then gargles with gravel.
Apparently he's in Jordan Peele's new movie, Nope, which I think opened today or yesterday.
Well, I
haven't seen
it
yet,
tomorrow.
But apparently.
I'm noping to go see it tomorrow.
You shouldn't have got us started on Michael Wincott because, that guy's a legend. Again, in Strange
Days.
Well,
I was thinking about putting him in this category, but I thought, I don't know. Like, I mean, we are getting sidetracked. Michael Wincott has just that quality where, again, there's so many of these actors that we talk about, like, they could be leading men. Like, he's a handsome dude, Michael
Wincott.
He is,
yeah.
But there is an essential danger to him that I think, like, is – it's almost like subconscious where you look at him and you're like, I don't know. I could trust him as a good guy. I'm reading the Mad Max Fury Road.
The Blood and Chrome one. Like,
yeah, that's right. And George Miller talks about the casting. Yeah, it's fantastic. Amazing that film got made. Like I'm about halfway through it. It's like it's amazing that everyone just didn't give up. But talking about the casting of Tom Hardy. And, you know, George's, the similarities he saw between Tom and Mel, which is this kind of inherent, I think he describes them as almost like caged animals. Like there is this sort of real animal quality, which, you know, has proven true with Mel. And you can totally get it with Tom Hardy. And I think Michael Wincott is not as unstable as those two. But there is just, there's a seething kind of like, anger or bad guy underneath, which I think in The Crow, they nail really, really well.
Yeah, it's same in Strange Days, same in Prince of Thieves, even that god-awful Three Musketeers from the early 90s with Charlie Sheen and Kiefer Sutherland. I think he's rocking an eye patch in that and just like, why isn't the whole movie about you? he's fantastic. I love Michael Wincott. But someone else I love is David Patrick Kelly, who he was in the aforementioned Dreamscape playing an absolute psycho with the great psycho name of Tommy Ray Glattman. Who can
is Dreamscape the same film with Christopher Plummer?
That's the one with Christopher Plummer. Yeah, I mean,
Yeah, right.
There's secret experiments going on at some college where Max von Sydow is developing some technology that needs, psychics with it as well, that you can go into people's dreams and sort of interact with them. And, you know, if you're having, you know, massive nightmares, then, you know, in comes Dennis Quaid to sort it out, except they send in David Patrick Kelly, who then kills you in your dream. So, but he just plays like a really, going back to the sort of the core tenet of our discussion today, sleazy guys. Tommy Ray Gatton is a sleaze. I mean, the first time he meets Dennis Quaid, he sort of rocks into his room, tries on his leather jacket without asking, and says, "Bet I could get a lot of gash in a jacket like this." Like, dude, really?
Dude.
But then he does the same he's Sully in Commando opposite Schwarzenegger.
You know, that's right.
Yeah, he's the one. And, you know, even before he's doing all this, you know, villainous shit to Schwarzenegger, he's just sort of sleazing around the airport trying to pick up Ray Dawn Chong after she's got off her flight. And when she turns him down, he's just like, "You fucking whore." It's like, yeah, this guy's just bad news.
So why he's so good in Twin Peaks is he's kind of like the you know, just the kind of mooching brother who's always looking for deals, always looking to make money and stuff. And you're right, he's just got this inherent kind of untrustworthiness to him. He reminds me a little bit, I get him confused sometimes with, you know, he's Jack Nicholson's mate, Tracy Walter.
From Repo Man.
Tim Burton's. Yeah, that's right. He's just, there's a similar kind of weaselly little quality bit, about the two of them.
Yeah, it's like, how do you function in society? You know, so yeah, David Patrick Kelly, but an A-grade sleaze and seemingly a very nice fellow. I was watching some behind-the-scenes footage of Twin Peaks, and it was him and another actor, and DPK, you can call Bill Fichtner Bill Fichtner. I'm going to call David Patrick Kelly DPK.
I like it.
He was just, there were two actors, and they're sitting there, and he had a little mandolin, not a guitar, mandolin. And they just came up with this lovely tune as they collaborate. I'm like, didn't expect that from you, Dave. Nice work.
I wonder, I would be really interested to know, like, you know, these actors that we've talked about, like, what their price tag is. Like, they're prolific, clearly. Yeah. Like, I'm just looking at David Patrick DPK's, he does like 4 or 5 projects a year, film and TV.
Yeah, you'd think like, they'd be above scale, right? You think they...
You'd definitely be above scale, but I'm just wondering, like, does a director or does a producer or a production, do they value what this person brings? So it's like, hey, let's just make sure we've got a bit of money. We need a good villain or we need a good, like, character actor in this role. So
We only need him. We need him for a week or we need him for 4 days. Let's put aside 20, 30K, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, just to pay them well, because I would hate to think that David Patrick is like can't pay his mortgage or something because he deserves it.
Absolutely. Now, I don't know if you want to close out on that, but
well, we can wind it up. Yeah, you got something for?
Oh, no. I mean, I'm happy to keep talking, but the thing of it is, when I was talking about magazines before, I mentioned Film Comment. One of the articles that I found, and I'm actually holding it in my hot little hand now. It's called The Lives of Supporting Players. It's written by a great film writer named David Thompson. And it's this, first of all, a fantastic article in praise of supporting actors, which they're my guys. I love them. I mean, I love stars, but supporting actors are just, oh, man, you came in and you just, as I said, made a meal of it. Fantastic.
Yeah.
But then there's this huge list and they're little sort of capsule bios / appreciations of all these actors. And this was like maybe in 88 or 89 that I bought this magazine. But they're talking about guys like, guys and girls, like, say, Bonnie Bedelia, who, you know, come back in Die Hard, but she had a big career before that. Who else? Sorry. And this is also very early in these guys' careers, but then they went on to things a bit later. They're talking about Michael Gambon, who, of course, went on to be Dumbledore. Oh, yeah. But who else? The late, great Fred Ward. Rates are mentioned, mainly...
Speaking of Mamie Blues.
Yeah, David Strathern, fantastic actor. Tom Waits, rates are mentioned, because, of course, he's got a wonderful side hustle as as an actor. Ballad of Buster Scruggs. But one of my favourites, and this guy could have easily fit into sleazebag actors, is a guy named Nicholas Worth. Now, he's a big, stocky, bald dude, not unlike yours truly. Have you seen? You've seen Dark Man, of course, Charlie.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. He's the one who he's the bald guy that Liam Neeson makes the first face and he steals the money and then he gets thrown out the window by Larry Drake.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He's one of those, oh, that guy faces.
He's a that guy. They've written like six paragraphs on him, but it closes out with one of my favorite lines of writing of film criticism of all time. Worth is more than the actor's actor. He's the psychopath's psychopath. Put it on my tombstone.
That's brilliant. That's a good way to go out. Guy, thank you so much for coming back into the video store. Where can people find you on Twitter?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Robert Guy Davis. And if you want to listen,
Four Finger Discount.
Yeah, if you want to listen to these dulcet tones a little more, the show was called Four Finger Discount and part of the Four Finger Discount Network. Also has shows on The Simpsons, Seinfeld, Friends, South Park, doing a few film reviews myself on a show called The Sidetrack, which is going to be more nerdy shit like I've talked about today. So if you couldn't get enough of it today, track me down there.
Get some more there.
Yeah, just... I'm trying to get as many podcasts going as Charlie Clausen, but you know, I don't rate my chances because he's the hardest working man in show business.
I'll put links all in the episode description below. I'm Charlie Clausen.
I'm Guy Davis.